You know that you've come tonight to hear an intelligent understanding of the intelligent design hypothesis. Our speaker is one of the best people in the country today because he's perhaps one of the best known debaters and contributors to the intelligent design hypothesis. He is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. He now teaches as a professor of biological sciences at Lehigh University in Eastern Pennsylvania. Dr. Behe is away from his nine children tonight. And in particular, he has a son who is celebrating his 11th birthday tonight in Eastern Pennsylvania. And you know where he'd like to be, but he's really glad he's here with you too. But I was almost going to say that he would like you to sing Happy Birthday sooner in absentia for his son, but we won't get into that. Okay. All right. Dr. Michael Behe is the author of the widely reviewed Darwin's Black Box. And many of you know, if you're following the New York Times and most publications, that he will in several weeks be will be giving testimony at the court case involving intelligent design in Dover, Pennsylvania. Without further ado, please welcome with me Dr. Michael Behe.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks very much for that introduction, Bob. It's a pleasure to be with you folks here. I first came to the University of Minnesota 7 years ago now, 1998, and was invited here by Professor Chris McCosko. And I had a wonderful time then and have been back a couple times since and enjoy it each time. Let me say that Bob told you that, you know, my wife and I, we have nine children. And one of the fun things about traveling is that this afternoon I got to lay down in the hotel room and took a nap for an hour and was not interrupted by somebody jumping on my head or things like that. So it's a shame to miss Vincent's birthday, but it does have its advantages too. Okay, so let me start up here. And the first thing I have to say is that my provost wants to make sure everybody is clear that I am from Lehigh University, but I do not represent them. So what I'm telling you tonight is my views. And I'm going to talk on the topic of toward an intelligent understanding of the intelligent design hypothesis. Intelligent design, you know, I wrote a book on this about coming up on 10 years ago now, but many people are still kind of hazy about exactly what it means, and I'm hoping to try and explain it a little more clearly to you folks tonight. And although it was, I wrote my book 10 years ago, it seems to have come into the news, especially in the past 6 months or so. For example, this is a cover of Time magazine from, two months or so ago, a month and a half ago, in which they talk about the upcoming Dover events and the whole idea of intelligent design. They do a decent job, but you still can't quite understand what the heck this ID stuff is from the short discussion in a magazine such as Time. But the subject of intelligent design has been treated also in serious academic settings over the past number of years. So for people who are interested in getting a little bit more, a little more clearer view of what it entails, there are books such as this one, God and Design, edited by the philosopher of science Neil Manson, who collects a number of essays on the topic of the teleological argument. And I contributed one of those. Oh, thank you. And another one called Darwinism, Design, and Public Education, published by Michigan State University Press, has a number of collects a number of essays on that topic, on the more public policy implications of the topic. But I think the best book for somebody who really wants to get up to speed quickly on all of the arguments for and against various positions regarding the unfolding of life and so on, is this one, Debating Design, which was published by Cambridge University Press last year, is edited by Bill Dembski, who's an intelligent design proponent, and Michael Ruse, who is a Darwinian philosopher of science. And it collects essays not only from intelligent design proponents and Darwinists, but also from people called complexity theorists who disagree with both camps, other folks who call themselves theistic evolutionists, and it really is a good, broad understanding of the topic. For tonight, I'm going to present the design argument as I presented it in an op-ed piece that the New York Times published by me about 6 months ago this year, entitled Design for Living. The op-ed, it really actually was not on the front page. We just kind of, you know, Photoshop and stuff. It's wonderful what you can do with those things these days. But nonetheless, I'm going to go through the argument for design as I presented it there. And the outline of the argument is pretty simple. It's this. The first point is that I'm going to argue that design is not mystical. It's not something, you know, you close your eyes and raise your hands to see. It's deduced from the physical structure of a system. We deduce design from the physical structure of a system. The second point is that everyone agrees that aspects of biology appear to be designed. And by everyone, I mean everyone, including people who don't agree that the design is actually real. But nonetheless, they agree that it sure looks designed. The third point is that many scientists think that Darwinian processes explain biology. But I'm going to argue that there are structural obstacles to thinking that Darwinian processes can explain at least some features of biology. The fourth point is that the claims for Darwinian processes and for Darwinian theory to be able to explain the complex structures of life rest on undisciplined imagination, essentially that they are urban legends. And the last point is that the bottom line is that there is strong evidence for design, but little evidence for Darwinism. So let's start off with that first point, that design is not mystical, but rather it's deduced from the physical structure of a system. And to do that, let's take a look at this. So suppose you were walking with a friend by these mountains, and he asked you, how did those mountains get there? And you would say, well, I don't know. You know, I never took geology. You know, what, plate tectonics, volcanic activity, erosion, something like that. And he said to you, well, yeah, but why is that peak about 100 feet higher than that peak? And why is this one, say, you measure that, and that's, oh, maybe 300 feet from there? Why do you think that is? And you'd say, what? It has to look like something, you know. You know, that doesn't require any explanation. Look, it's just a mountain. And I think most people would be happy with that. Now suppose you and your friend walked by this mountain. And he asked you the same question. Where did this mountain come from? Well, part of the answer might be plate tectonics, and part of the answer might be erosion, and so on. But it is not a complete answer. You would immediately understand, is this clear? I'm not sure. Is it visible? It's not visible from my angle. Okay. You would immediately apprehend that the faces on this mountain are not the product of unintelligent forces like erosion or plate tectonics or some such thing. You would immediately apprehend that these are the products of design. Now when somebody says, well, why is this depression in this rock 3 feet from this ridge in this rock? Now you've got an answer. Because the function of these rocks is to portray the image of George Washington. Now it is no longer a senseless question. Now the parts of these rocks seem to interact to be doing something. They're not just kind of laying there as they were in the previous mountains. So that leads into our question, what is intelligent design? What do we mean by that? Well, design, the word design has a number of dictionary definition meanings, and one of them is this. Design is the purposeful arrangement of parts. When parts are put together to accomplish some purpose, some function, then that is design. Well, you know, when you do that, that is design, but what if you walk by something? How do you decide if it is designed? You decide it's designed when we infer that parts appear to be arranged to accomplish a function. The parts of those rocks on Mount Rushmore, they were arranged to do something. They weren't just there. They were arranged to portray different images. One other point that we have to keep in mind when we talk about this is that the strength of our inference to design is quantitative. The more parts that are arranged that seem to be arranged on purpose, and the more intricate their interaction and the more difficult their function, the more confident we can be in deducing design. If we saw a couple rocks lined up in a row, which, you know, if you look at them from one angle and the sun was just right, they kind of looked like, say, John Kennedy or something. Well, you know, most people wouldn't think that was design. You might think that's just an accident. But the more and more the rocks come to look like something, and, you know, the more parts that fit, the more confident we are of design. And you can get to a point where you're utterly certain that something was not an accident. Nobody, even if they had not heard of Mount Rushmore, walked by it, nobody would think that that was an accidental arrangement of rocks. So the point is that design is not mystical. It's deduced from the physical structure of a system. The second point, then, is that everyone agrees that aspects of biology appear to be designed. And by everyone, I'm going to use as my example of everyone a man named Richard Dawkins, who is a professor of biology at Oxford University in England, and perhaps the foremost popularizer of Darwinian theory today. He is a very strong proponent of Darwin's theory. But nonetheless, in his classic defense of Darwin's theory, which he called The Blind Watchmaker, on the first page of the first chapter of the book, he wrote the following. Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. That is what biology is. That is the very definition of biology, says Richard Dawkins. Of course, again, he doesn't think the design is real. He thinks it's just an appearance. But nonetheless, like Mount Rushmore, biology contains things that strongly appear to have been designed. Now, what does Richard Dawkins mean by design? Well, Dawkins, again, does not from design mean some fuzzy feeling that, you know, we get like when we see a pretty sunset or some such thing. He means the purposeful arrangement of parts, what an engineer would do to accomplish some function. He writes in The Blind Watchmaker, "We may say that a living body or organ is well designed if it has attributes that an intelligent and knowledgeable engineer might have built into it in order to achieve some sensible purpose, such as flying, swimming, seeing. Any engineer can recognize an object that has been designed, even poorly designed, for a purpose, and he can usually work out what that purpose is just by looking at the structure of the object. He can tell the purposeful arrangement of parts. They're put together in this case, to look like George Washington, in that case, to be able to fly, and so on. Now, Dawkins goes on to say that, of course, he thinks that natural selection is responsible for the appearance of design. But nonetheless, this appearance of design, he's not kind of begrudgingly talking about some faint appearance of design in biology. He insists that the appearance of design in biology is overwhelming. He writes, "Natural selection is the blind watchmaker, blind because it does not see ahead, does not plan consequences, has no purposes in view. Yet, the living results of natural selection overwhelmingly impress us with the appearance of design, as if by a master watchmaker, impress us with the illusion of design and planning." So he's not saying this is a faint appearance. This is overwhelming. Now, the title of Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker, is actually an allusion back to a book that was written more than 150 years before Dawkins' book. And it is an answer to that book. It was a book written by a man named William Paley, who was an Anglican clergyman, and who in the year 1802 wrote a book called Natural Theology. And his is perhaps the most famous example of the design argument from that era. And Paley was a very good amateur biologist as well. And he went through many, many different features of life and strongly argued that they appeared to be designed. But his most famous portion of that book, Natural Theology, is when he talks about how we perceive design, how we come to the conclusion of design. He has a famous paragraph where he says, "Suppose you were out walking across a field and you stumbled across a stone and you asked yourself, where did that stone come from?" And he said, you might answer that for all you know, it might have been there forever. But now suppose you were walking across the field and you stumbled across a watch. He said, you would not conclude the same thing. He said, when we come to inspect the watch, we perceive that its several parts are framed and put together for a purpose. That is, that they are so formed and adjusted as to produce motion, and that motion so regulated as to point out the hour of the day. The inference, we think, is inevitable, that the watch must have had a maker, the purposeful arrangement of parts. So Paley, you know, strongly says that when we see things like this, we infer design. And when we see something so finely crafted as a watch, we immediately conclude that it must have had a maker. But Dawkins named his book The Blind Watchmaker because he said that natural selection can, in fact, make that fine watch that Paley thought required a real intelligent designer. So Paley, at the beginning of his book, makes this analogy to this finely crafted mechanical object. And he wrote in 1802. In the 200 plus years since Paley wrote, the comparison between parts of life and designed mechanical objects has become enormously stronger. Very, very, very much stronger. When Paley wrote, science knew nothing about the cell or the molecular basis of life. And in the past, especially past 50 years, we've learned a tremendous deal about that. And for a good taste of the strength of Paley's analogy now to parts of life, one place to look is this issue of the journal Cell, which was published in 1998, a special review issue on the topic of macromolecular machines. And if you look in the lower left-hand corner
of the cover, you see this vague mechanical type object. It looks like maybe it's a watch, maybe something like Paley's watch. And if you turn the cover of the journal and look at the table of contents, you'll see listed there articles with titles such as "The Cell as a Collection of Protein Machines," "Polymerases in the Replisome, Machines Within Machines," "Mechanical Devices of the Spliceosome, Motors, Clocks, Springs, and Things." And the editor of this special review issue was a man named Bruce Alberts. And Bruce Alberts, up until about 2 months ago, was the president of the National Academy of Sciences and a very well-known biochemist. And he wrote an introductory article, the introductory article, "The Cell as a Collection of Protein Machines, Preparing the Next Generation of Molecular Biologists." And in that article, among other things, he said that in order to train our students to understand the cell and the next generation, we have to teach them engineering principles. We have to give them a good engineering background. And he talks about how much we've learned since he was a student. He says, "The chemistry that makes life possible is much more elaborate and sophisticated than anything we students had ever considered." He's talking about his own student's days. "Indeed, the entire cell can be viewed as a factory that contains an elaborate network of interlocking assembly lines, each of which is composed of a set of large protein machines." And he emphasizes that here and in the issue, the word "machines" is not meant as some sort of analogy. It is meant quite literally. These are machines. He writes, "Why do we call the large protein assemblies that underlie cell function protein machines?" And that's his emphasis, his italics. "Precisely because," this is mine, "like the machines invented by humans, these protein assemblies contain highly coordinated moving parts. The functional, you know, the functional arrangement of parts, exactly what design is." Okay, so the point is then that everyone agrees that aspects of biology appear to be designed. But nonetheless, Bruce Alberts does not think there is actual design in the cell. He agrees with Richard Dawkins, who thinks that natural selection is responsible for this apparent design. It only looks designed. So in the next section of the talk, I want to argue that, in fact, there are structural obstacles to Darwinian evolution. Okay, if you look at it closely at the molecular level, there are problems with envisioning a Darwinian explanation for these molecular machines. And the problem was anticipated by Charles Darwin himself. In The Origin of Species, Darwin wrote, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down," adding, "but I can find out no such case." Here, Darwin was emphasizing that natural selection had to work slowly, in tiny steps, over vast periods of time. He knew that if new functions, new structures, seemed to come up quickly in big leaps, then it would look suspiciously like something other than random mutation and natural selection were involved. This would be a structural obstacle if something could not be put together in numerous successive slight modifications. Well, okay, what sort of a organ or what sort of a system, you know, does not look like it's amenable to this gradualistic construction? Can't be put together by numerous successive slight modifications. Well, a system which is what I call irreducibly complex, or has the property of irreducible complexity. And that's kind of a fancy phrase, but it just means that you've got some system or machine or something that has a number of different parts. And the parts interact to produce some function. And if you take away one of the parts, then the function is lost. And as an illustration of such of an irreducibly complex object from our everyday life, I've pointed to the mousetrap, the humble little mousetrap. The mousetrap has a number of different parts. It's got this wooden platform to which everything else is attached. It's got this tightly wound spring here with extended ends to press against the platform here and also to press against this other metal part, which is called the hammer, which actually squashes the mouse. And when you put the hammer over here, it's got to be held in position till the mouse comes along. That's the job of something called the holding bar here. And the end of the holding bar itself has to be inserted into something called the catch in order to stabilize it until the mouse comes along. Now, the mousetrap needs all these parts to work. If it was missing the spring, if it was missing the platform, if it was missing the holding bar, you would not have a trap that worked half as well as it used to, or a quarter as well as it used to. You would have a broken mousetrap. It would not work at all. So this is what I mean by irreducibly complex. It's a pretty simple concept. But nonetheless, things like this are very difficult to explain in a gradualistic framework, the gradualistic framework like Darwin's. Suppose you wanted to make something like a mousetrap by something like a Darwinian process. You know, how would you do it? What would you start with? You know, would you start with, say, the wooden platform and, you know, hope to catch mice inefficiently? You know, maybe trip them or something. And then maybe, I don't know, add the holding bar. And maybe when they trip, they'd impale themselves on the holding bar. Now, you can't do it like that, because with irreducibly complex systems, the function doesn't appear until the system is essentially put together. So things like this, which seem to require all their parts to work, are big headaches for Darwinian approaches. Well, the question is, are there any irreducibly complex biological systems or cellular systems or, you know, biochemical systems? And the answer is, yeah, there are tons of them. There are tons of them. And one good example, a good visual example, is this one. This is called the bacterial flagellum, which has gotten a little lot of press, too, since intelligent design has gone mainstream. And it, quite literally, is an outboard motor that bacteria use to swim. This is an illustration of the flagellum taken from a biochemistry textbook by Vogt and Vogt, which is widely used in universities across the country. And like a regular outboard motor, the flagellum has a number of parts. It's got this part, which acts as the propeller, which actually spins round and round and around and pushes against water and therefore pushes the bacterium forward. The propeller is attached to the drive shaft by something called the hook region, which acts as a universal joint, transmitting the rotary motion of the drive shaft up to the propeller. The drive shaft is attached to the motor, which uses a flow of acid from the outside of the cell to the inside to power the turning. The whole apparatus is kept stationary in the plane of the membrane by some proteins which act as a stator, clamping it onto the membrane, just as you have to clamp on a real outboard motor onto a boat while it's working. The drive shaft has to poke up through the bacterial membrane, and there are some proteins which act as bushing material. And while this looks complex, let me assure you, this is just a little cartoon version of the flagellum. And work in the past couple decades has shown there are dozens of different complex protein parts. And they're not just simple little rings and stuff. These are just, again, cartoon versions of very complicated molecules, many copies of which are necessary in the flagellum. Well, perhaps you can tell just by looking at it that, like the mousetrap, the flagellum is irreducibly complex. What if you didn't have this hook? What if you didn't have the propeller? What if you didn't have the drive shaft? You would not have a flagellum that spun half as fast as it used to, or a quarter as fast. You would not have, it wouldn't spin at all. Or more likely, in the cell, the whole apparatus simply wouldn't be built, because the cell has to invest a large amount of resources into making this rather large structure. And it has sensitive and sophisticated feedback systems to tell it when construction is going well or not well, and it will shut down construction if things aren't going well. Now, I like to show audiences this drawing from the biochemistry textbook, because most people, when they look at this, do quickly realize that this is a machine. It is not analogous to a machine. It's not like a machine. This is a real machine. And when you say the phrase purposeful arrangement of parts, we look at that and we know exactly what we're talking about. Okay, so the flagellum is irreducibly complex. And again, like the mousetrap, its production by numerous successive slight modifications in a Darwinian-type pathway is very, very difficult to envision. Okay, I'm going to skip over this next slide, but there's a real good story behind that, but I'm going to skip over it anyway. Sorry. running low on time. But nonetheless, don't we already have explanations for these things? Now, most people who take classes in biology or read Scientific American or have a passing acquaintance oftentimes are under the impression that we've already got this figured out. You know, I'm sure somewhere in the literature somebody's figured that out. I was like that until about 15 years ago. I thought somebody must know. I don't know how this could have occurred, but I'm sure somebody must know. My teacher said this is the case. But I want to show you in this section of the talk that, in fact, grand Darwinian claims, and not small Darwinian claims, Darwinian processes do some things. And they explain a number of things in biology. But the claims that they explain such sophisticated machinery as the flagellum and other things, such as that alluded to in the cell, the issue of cell, rest on undisciplined imagination. And like I said before, they're urban legends. You know, everybody talks about them, but they're really not there. Okay, and the best way to do that, I think, is to look at responses to my book, Darwin's Black Box, which was published coming up on 10 years ago now. It was published in 1996. And I claimed that not only do we see design in the cell, but I went through the literature and said that Darwinian explanations for these complex systems are not there. There are simply no articles explaining these things in anything but the most hand-wavy of terms. And since the book came out, it's been widely reviewed. New York Times, Washington Post, a lot of places have reviewed it. And among these reviewers have been scientists, molecular biologists, biochemists, evolutionary biologists. What have they had to say about these claims? Well, they've had a lot of things to say, not all of them kind. For example, James Shreve, who is a science writer focusing on paleontology, wrote in the New York Times, "Mr. Behe may be right that given our current state of knowledge, good old Darwinian evolution cannot explain the origin of blood clotting or cellular transport." James Shapiro, who's a professor of microbiology at the University of Chicago, wrote, "There are no detailed Darwinian accounts for the evolution of any fundamental biochemical or cellular system, only a variety of wishful speculations." Jerry Coyne, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago, wrote in a review in Nature, the most prominent science journal in the world, There is no doubt that the pathways described by Behe are dawningly complex, and their evolution will be hard to unravel. We may forever be unable to envisage the first proto-pathways. In other words, we don't have answers now. And Andrew Pomenkowski says something similar. And that's my favorite one there. I can blow it up if you'd like. I can enlarge the... At least one person liked it. But nonetheless, that's been the general reaction by many reviewers, that you're right, the answers aren't there. But some reviewers have said, well, sure they're there. You know, they're out there. Don't, you know, we've got good answers for all those things. And that is the response that a man named David Griffin has received. David Griffin is a professor of religion at Claremont College in California. He wrote a book called Religion and Scientific Naturalism a few years ago. And he wrote, "The response I have received from repeating Behe's claim about the evolutionary literature, which simply brings out the point being made implicitly by many others, such as Crick, Denton, Shapiro, Stanley, Taylor, and Wesson, is that I obviously have not read the right books. There are, I am assured, evolutionists who have described how the transitions in question could have occurred." And he continues, "But when I ask in which books I can find these discussions, however, I either get no answer or else some titles that, upon examination, do not, in fact, contain the promised accounts. That such accounts exist seems to be something that is widely known, but I have yet to encounter anyone who knows where they exist." So again, the phrase urban legend comes to mind. Everybody thinks, yeah, we got it under control, but when you go and look where, nobody has explained these things. I think the best short summary of this position was written in a book called The Way of the Cell by a man named Franklin Harold, who's an emeritus professor of biochemistry at Colorado State University. Way of the Cell was published by Oxford University Press a few years ago, prestigious academic publishing house. And he touches on intelligent design at one point. And he has the following to say. He says, "We should reject, as a matter of principle, the substitution of intelligent design for the dialogue of chance and necessity." And he cites my book. "But we must concede that there are presently no detailed Darwinian accounts of the evolution of any biochemical system, only a variety of wishful speculations," kind of echoing James Shapiro. Well, let's just take 1 minute to look at the two points he makes here. He makes two points, and let's take them in reverse order. He says that there are no detailed Darwinian accounts. There are no accounts. We don't know how these things arose. Only a variety of wishful speculations, or more popularly known as just-so stories. You know, like the children's stories written by Rudyard Kipling, you know, over 100 years ago. How the a tiger got its stripes, how the rhinoceros got its horn, how the bacterium got its flagellum. You know, it's funny, but if you think about it for a little while longer, it's astonishing that this theory that claims the allegiance of the bulk of the scientific community has been so utterly fruitless at explaining the molecular foundations of life. And it makes you think that perhaps some other explanation might be called for. Now, the second point that Franklin Harold made is that he said we should reject, as a matter of principle, intelligent design. What's that principle? What principle? He doesn't say. He just pens that little paragraph and then goes on to other things. But what principle is that? You know, when you look at that drawing of the flagellum, design pops into your head right away. You know, this is not something that's hard to see. But nonetheless, for some reason, we seem to be forbidden to entertain that idea. Well, what principle is that? Well, again, he doesn't say, but I think the principle he had in mind is this. And that is that intelligent design seems to point strongly beyond nature. It seems to have philosophical and even theological implications. And that makes some people nervous. They think science should stay away from things that seem to point so strongly beyond nature. Well, I understand, you know, how they feel, but I disagree with them. When I was being trained as a student in science, we were always told that science is supposed to follow the evidence wherever it leads. Let other people worry about the philosophical or other implications. That's not our job. We follow the evidence. And I think that was good advice back then, and I continue to think it's good advice. Okay, in addition to these general claims, first, that many reviewers admit that there are no explanations. Some people say, yeah, they're out there, but when you look for them, you can't find them. In a couple of cases, reviewers of my book or people responding to my book have pointed to specific systems and said, look, here's a paper in the literature that demonstrates you're wrong. This principle of irreducible complexity, for example, is wrong, and here's an experiment to show it. And in each case, when you look at the claims closely, they fall apart. And I want to illustrate with just one pretty clear example tonight, and it has to do with the blood clotting system. Most people don't think, you know, about the blood clotting system. You know, a guy, for example, you know, gets up in the morning, you know, shaves, you know, you nick yourself with a razor, a little bit of blood trickles out, slows down, stops, heals over. You know, what's the big deal? From the outside, blood clotting looks like a pretty simple process. But investigation in the past 50 years or so has shown that it is an enormously complex biochemical system with dozens of different protein parts. And I wrote about it in a section or in a chapter of Darwin's Black Box and claimed that it was irreducibly complex and therefore had to be designed. Here's an illustration of what's called the blood clotting cascade from a textbook. And it's called a cascade because we have one factor acting on another, acting on another. For example, the material which forms the clot itself is called fibrinogen. But fibrinogen can't actually form the clot. Or if the material that was to form the clot existed in the clot-like structure, then all your blood would be solidified. And you'd kind of stand there like this, you know, and you'd be in bad shape. The actual material of the clot itself is called fibrin. Fibrinogen is actually a soluble form piece of what will turn into the clot. It floats around in your blood waiting for you to cut yourself or some such thing. And then it gets transformed from that soluble fibrinogen into something called fibrin by having a piece of this fibrinogen cut off of it by another molecule called thrombin, a protein. And the cutting off that piece exposes a sticky area of the fibrinogen, which allows it to stick to itself, forming these fisherman's net kind of structures that form the blood clot you saw in the last slide. But thrombin can't exist in the active form, or it would immediately activate all the fibrinogen, turning it into fibrin, and again, you'd be in big trouble. So it exists as an inactive precursor called prothrombin. But prothrombin has to be activated, turned into thrombin by another factor, which itself is in an inactive form. And that has to be activated by another factor, which is activated by another factor, and so on. So this is called a cascade because one thing acts on another, and so on. So I argued this as an example of design. And that's what I said, but a man named Russell Doolittle disagreed with me. And he wrote about his disagreement in an article called A Delicate Balance, which was published in a magazine called Boston Review, which is put out by MIT. Shortly after my book came out. Book came out in 96. He wrote this in 97. And that really wasn't all that good for me because Russell Doolittle is a prominent scientist. He's a professor of biochemistry at the University of California, San Diego, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, who has worked on the blood clotting system for the past 40 years. So he is not the kind of guy that you want on the other side. And he wrote that far from this system being irreducibly complex, there is already evidence there's an experiment in the literature showing that it's not irreducibly complex. He wrote the following. Recently, the gene for plasminogen, there should be an S there, it's a misspelling. The gene for plasminogen was knocked out of mice. That means by molecular biological techniques, the gene was broken. And predictably, those mice had thrombotic complications because fibrin clots could not be cleared away. Plasminogen is like a chemical scissors which chops up blood clots once their job is done and allows them to clear away. If you can't clear away the blood clots and they linger on, your veins get gunked up. Not long after that, the same workers knocked out the gene for fibrinogen in another line of mice. Again, fibrinogen is the precursor of the clot material itself. Again, predictably, these mice were ailing, although in this case, hemorrhage was the problem. Can't form clots. And what do you think happened when these two lines of mice were crossed? For all practical purposes, the mice lacking both genes were normal. Contrary to claims about irreducible complexity, the entire ensemble of proteins is not needed. Music and harmony can arise from a smaller orchestra. So the point is this. Well, yeah, sure. You know, if you knock out this protein, the mice have problems. Or if in another line of mice you knock out this protein, yeah, they have problems. But if you combine them into one line of mice missing both components, they're okay. And so, you know, maybe evolution doesn't have to go by, you know, a couple dozen proteins at a time. Maybe it can go two at a time or some such thing. He doesn't really spell out the implications after that, and we probably shouldn't spend too much time worrying about it because it turns out that Russell Doolittle was wrong. He misread the paper that he was citing this work from. The mice are in big trouble. This is the paper from the journal Cell that he cited. Loss of fibrinogen rescues mice from the pleiotropic effects of plasminogen deficiency. Russell Doolittle saw the phrase rescues mice, and he thought that the mice were normal. Turns out they're not. In the abstract of the paper, the authors write, mice deficient in plasminogen and fibrinogen are phenotypically indistinguishable from fibrinogen deficient mice. Translated into English, that means that mice missing both proteins have all the problems that mice missing only fibrinogen have. Their blood doesn't clot. They hemorrhage. Female mice die during pregnancy. They are not happy campers. They are not promising evolutionary intermediates. Here's a table listing the symptoms of the various lines of mice. Mice lacking plasminogen have this suite of symptoms. Mice lacking fibrinogen have this suite of symptoms. Mice lacking both have been rescued from the symptoms of plasminogen deficiency. But only to suffer the problems of fibrinogen deficiency. Now, if you think about it for just a minute, you can figure out what's going on here. Plasminogen is a protein that clears away blood clots once their job is done. If you don't have plasminogens, the blood clots hang around, you have thrombosis and assorted problems. Things get gunked up. Without fibrinogen, you can't form clots. You hemorrhage, female mice die in pregnancy. If you're missing both, it doesn't matter that you're missing plasminogen because you can't form clots in the first place. So you don't form blood clots that you can't clear because you can't form blood clots at all. The same workers who did this went on to knock out other factors in the blood clotting cascade in other lines of mice. And here's a table showing that. They knocked out something called prothrombin and tissue factor. And in each case, the blood clotting cascade is broken, which is exactly what you'd expect if, in fact, the cascade were irreducibly complex, as I had claimed. So, what do we conclude from this mistake that Russell Doolittle made? The point is not that he misread a paper. Anybody can misread a paper. You know, scientists are not known for the clarity of their prose. And it took me a while to plow through this paper of Bouget et al. Now, the point instead is this, that Russell Doolittle knows as much about the blood clotting cascade as any person on Earth. He knows the structures of the proteins. He knows the composition of the genes. He knows the similarity between different structures, and so on. But nonetheless, I think you can tell from his mistake that he does not know how Darwinian processes could have put together the blood clotting cascade. If he did, he would have simply told us in that article, or he would have pointed to papers in the literature showing where it had been explained. Instead, he pointed to a paper that talked about hemorrhaging mice. So the point is this. Russell Doolittle is the man when it comes to the blood clotting system. And if Russell Doolittle does not know how Darwinian processes could put this system together, nobody knows. Nobody in the entire world knows. And that's actually a good point to keep in mind, because this topic is really rather emotional, it turns out. You know, people get so worked up when talking about evolution. And a lot of people will come up to you and say that, yes, we do know how such things were put together. Or they'll say, yes, science does know how it's done. And they will look you in the eye, and they will confidently say that that's the case. And that's actually an important point, and I want to spend a minute or two on that. For example, there's a man named Michael Ruse, who I think his name came up earlier in the talk. He's a prominent philosopher of biology, in particular a student of Darwinian thought. He's written maybe a dozen or more books on various aspects of Darwin's life, his thought, how it impinges on philosophy, and so on. And in 1998, he wrote an article called Answering the Creationists, Where They Go Wrong and What They're Afraid Of. And in it, he had the following to say. He said, for example, Behe is a real scientist, but this case for the impossibility of a small step natural origin of biological complexity has been trampled upon contemptuously by the scientists working in the field. They think his grasp of the pertinent science is weak, and his knowledge of the literature curiously, although conveniently, outdated. For example, far from the evolution of clotting being a mystery, the past three decades of work by Russell Doolittle and others has thrown significant light on the ways in which clotting came into being. More than this, it can be shown that the clotting mechanism does not have to be a one-step phenomenon with everything already in place and functioning. One step in the cascade involves fibrinogen required for clotting, and another, plasminogen. Oh, that's missing an S there. It's a typo, I suppose. Plasminogen required for clearing clots. And he goes on in this article to quote the passage from Russell Doolittle, the exact passage that I showed you on the previous slide. Plasminogen. With Russell Doolittle, it was a typo. With Michael Ruse, he copied Doolittle's description. Now, here's a guy who is so confident that Darwinian explanations are correct that he doesn't even bother to look up the different sides of the argument, but he assumes that the expert in the field is correct. Okay, and this is a philosopher who decides not only is this side wrong, but it's contemptuously wrong. So the point is that, some people will look you in the eye and claim that we know Darwinian evolution is true, but we know no such thing. Okay, well, Michael Ruse is a philosopher, and what do they know anyway? But Neil Greenspan is a scientist, and they know everything. Neil Greenspan is a professor of pathology at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. And just in 2002, he wrote an article called Not So Intelligent Design, another fan, and had it published in a magazine called The Scientist. And he had the following to say. He said, "The design advocates also ignore the accumulating examples of the reducibility of biological systems. As Russell Doolittle has noted in commenting on the writings of one ID advocate, who shall remain nameless, mice, genetically altered so that they lack either thrombin or fibrinogen, have the expected abnormal hemostatic phenotypes. However, when the separate knockout mice are bred, the double knockouts apparently have normal hemostasis, reducible complexity, after all, at least in the laboratory." So this is the exact argument of Russell Doolittle. So he does not have any independent knowledge that Doolittle does not have, nor does Michael Ruse. Thrombin or fibrinogen? It was plasminogen and fibrinogen. Now, here's a guy, a scientist, who has the ability to go into the science library, take out the paper, read it, find out what the hubbub is about. But he's so confident of the correctness of Darwinian theory that he doesn't even think that is necessary. So the point is that some people will make strong claims, but the nice thing about science is that the results are in the library, and if the results aren't there, then essentially they are incorrect. And Greenspan goes on to say, with delicious irony, "These results cast doubt on the claim by proponents of ID that they know which systems exhibit irreducible complexity and which do not." But now, since the results are actually the exact opposite of what Greenspan and Ruse and Doolittle thought, the shoe is on the other foot. These results show that Darwinists do not know when their theory has problems, and they either will not or cannot recognize those problems, and so it's up to other people to point them out for them. Okay, so that point was that grand Darwinian claims rest on undisciplined imagination, and I hope I was able to convince you of that. And this is the bottom line, then, is that we have strong evidence for design, but little evidence for Darwinism. The little evidence for Darwinism, I hope you saw in my review of the literature in the past few minutes. But remind me again, what is this strong evidence for design? It's this. The living results overwhelmingly impress us with the appearance of design as if by a master watchmaker, impress us with the illusion of design and planning. We apprehend design in the purposeful arrangement of parts. That is everywhere in biology. That is the strong evidence for design. Well, what sort of an argument is that? That, you know, these things, you know, have the appearance of design like Mount Rushmore, and that therefore we can infer that they were designed. Well, the structure of the argument is kind of represented by this. What is that? Well, if it looks like a duck. And if it walks and quacks like a duck, then we are rationally justified in concluding that unless somebody shows us strong evidence otherwise, it is a duck. That's the kind of a colloquial way of looking at it. But philosophers have a name for this argument. They call it an inductive argument. Sorry. Well, okay. Well, what is inductive, an inductive argument? And what's this got to do with science anyway? Well, look at the Encyclopedia Britannica under inductive reasoning. When a person uses a number of established facts to draw a general conclusion, he uses inductive reasoning. This is the kind of logic normally used in the sciences. So our inference to design is the same sort of logic using the same sort of evidence that is used in standard science. So one more time, the argument is that design is not mystical, it's deduced from the physical structure of a system. Everybody sees this design. Nobody fails to see it. There are structural obstacles to the main theory, Darwinian evolution, in accounting for the design that we see. Claims that, in fact, Darwinian processes have been shown to explain it are urban legends, and that the bottom line is that, in fact, we do have strong evidence for design and little for Darwinism. Now, I've shown you a number of criticisms of the design argument in this talk. And besides these, there have been many other criticisms of the design argument. And I've responded to a number of criticisms, and I've written a couple of papers in academic books and a couple of articles in philosophy of science journals. But most accessibly, I've written replies and responses which can be found at this website. So people who are interested in the nitty-gritty of these can look it up there. Now, that's where, you know, my responses are. If you want to read the criticisms themselves, the original articles containing the criticisms, they're easy to find, too. You just, you know, go to an internet search engine, type in my name plus any common swear word, and you'll get tons of hits. And thanks very much for your attention.
No doubt you have questions, so let's immediately go to questions in the next 25 minutes. I'm going to take right up here in front.
I think most of us can immediately appreciate what the impact on culture, philosophy, and such if intelligent design were to be widely accepted, and you can't really underplay the large impact that would have on what we teach our kids and so forth. This is obviously where the front line of the battle is. My question is, within the narrow realm of science, if intelligent design were to be accepted generally, how would that change how we do the research beyond the postulate gee, an intelligent designer must exist. What can you do? I mean, is there a way of quantifying design? Is there a way of coming up with a measure that says this has a high design factor or some such thing?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I guess the brief answer is that it probably wouldn't affect 99.9% of the research too much. Because 99.9% of biological research is just into how things work. And in fact, 99.9% of research already assumes that parts are arranged for a purpose. Biology already takes an implicit design stance. It's just that people in the do their work, and in the recesses of their mind, they say to themselves, "Oh, isn't it wonderful what natural selection has provided?" But you might call their approach methodological design, because the methods they employ assume that all of the parts are there for a purpose. The second part of your comment is a good, insightful one. One thing that you can do, however, if you're a design, if you're working in a design framework, is ask yourself the question, well, okay, these magnificent machines, molecular machines, are clearly designed, but not everything in the cell is designed. Here's a pseudogene over here that looks like, it's lost the ability to code for a protein. Looks like it was broken by some random genetic accident. That probably wasn't design. There is sickle cell hemoglobin. Sickle cell hemoglobin is one change in one amino acid out of 150 or so amino acids in one protein of hemoglobin, which is common in Africa because it helps confer resistance to malaria. That's a simple change. It's easy to see that arising by random mutation and natural selection. But what if you need three or four changes or some such thing? How much change can unintelligent processes produce? Or to kind of look at it by the flip side, how deeply into the cell, into life, does design extend? And there you can ask good questions with standard molecular biological tools about things like how much can unintelligent processes really do? What is the tolerance to molecular machines, to changes, and other interesting questions like that. So there's a lot of things one can do, but quite frankly, the bulk of research would stay the same because the bulk of research is being done under an implicit design assumption anyway.
Okay, I'm going to have a difficult time covering everybody and not even come close. I'm going to pick somebody who looks like a student, and then I will get to several more of you up here.
You showed us some silly weaknesses of experts in blood clotting. I'm wondering, for the sake of full disclosure, what are some of the best objections or challenges to the hypothesis of intelligent design?
Let's see. Frankly, I think that was one of the best. And there are a couple like that. When I read Russell Doolittle's article, I was sweating because I said, oh no, here's experimental evidence, And I thought, what am I going to do here? Maybe I'm wrong. And then I went out and read the paper and read it again and said, uh-oh, and figured out that, it was not what it was claimed to be. There have been a number of other papers like that put forward by other biologists that said, look at this, look at how much natural selection has done here. And each time, my hands started to shake. And each time I went to the library, and like Doolittle's, they were either misread or grossly exaggerated so that the results would fit well within what I would expect as a design proponent. So the only arguments that give me pause are not one. I do not worry about arguments where somebody gets up and says, well, look how similar this protein is to that. It's easy to imagine this going into that. Hey, what's the problem? I consider those just so stories. What I'm concerned with is when somebody claims to have experimental evidence showing that natural selection, random mutation can do more than I expected. And over the years, a number of those have been advanced, and they have always turned out to be of the same caliber as this. So right now, I don't think there are any good arguments, scientific arguments against intelligent design. There are philosophical ones, which, if you don't believe there can be such a person as a designer, if you see such, you don't see any reason that there could be a designer beyond Earth or some such thing, then you have to weigh the improbability of the existence of a designer against the improbability that some, unlikely mutation would come up to actually do these things. And those are interesting arguments. But they're not scientific arguments, I don't think. The long and the short is that I don't think there are right now any good scientific arguments. There are interesting philosophical problems to deal with, none that I think are fatal, but interesting nonetheless.
Yes. In the Time magazine article you showed us at the beginning of your talk, you're quoted as saying, "You can't prove intelligent design by an experiment." In an interview in the Boston Globe this summer, George Gilder, who's a co-founder and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, which promotes intelligent design, said, "Intelligent design itself does not have any content." Don't these admissions reveal intelligent design to be an urban legend or a just-so story?
Okay. Okay, very good points. No, is the short answer. By that quote from me, I can't speak for George Gilder. I don't know what he had in mind, but it's really hard to draw conclusions from short quotes. Here's what I meant by that thing in Time. You can't do an experiment to show design. Suppose you were standing in front of Mount Rushmore with a buddy, and the buddy says, "No, I think it was erosion. I've been reading up about this chaos theory, and I think, if there were, people close by, erosion and wind and stuff, with amplification from chaotic, blah, 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 I think it might have been natural forces." And he says, "Give me an experiment that would show this was designed." And you'd say, "The evidence for the design is in the purposeful arrangement of the parts. That is the evidence right there. I can't get out a test tube and show you why Mount Rushmore is designed. It's right there." The burden, and then you would say, "In our experience, we have never seen chaotic forces bouncing off people's face to erode a mountain in this fashion. So you show me why I should disregard my uniform experience and give credit to your theory." But I, the design advocate, could not design an experiment to show that Mount Rushmore was designed. That's what I meant by that.
Okay, let's go back here.
Thank you. You seem to be attacking a theory by pointing out places where it hasn't, in a detailed way, explained certain phenomena. When I don't think that many scientists, and I think that no philosophers of science, would say that a theory would at any point give an exhaustive explanation of how of the events in the world. So how do you respond to my question of, do you think that this is a good way to attack a theory in general?
Well, I'm not trying to attack anything that has such negative overtones. I'm trying to build something. Yes, that's it. That's positive. I'm not trying to attack. I'm just trying to explain why I think Darwinian explanations, which are kind of the default assumed explanation, appear to me not to be good explanations, that in fact they really can't do what they purport to do. And rather, with our experience, there's an argument to be made for this other point of view. So I'm not really attacking anything. But let me try to give you an analogy or another example that might explain kind of this situation. And it's an analogy in physics. In the early part of the 20th century, in the 1910s, 1920s, and before that, most physicists thought that the universe was timeless, eternal, unchanging. And then, around 1930 or so, the redshift of light from distant galaxies was interpreted to show that everything seems to be rushing away from each other, as if in the aftermath of a giant explosion. And that was, of course, then the beginning of the Big Bang theory, that the universe had a beginning. Now, this idea, a lot of physicists hated that idea. A lot of physicists still hate that idea, because many people thought it had strong philosophical and even theological overtones. Maybe this was the creation. I was just reading a quote by a chemist named Walter Nernst of that age. He was a very prominent chemist who said that if you give up a timeless universe, you are attacking the very foundations of science. But the people who proposed the Big Bang Theory weren't trying to attack the foundations of science. They were just trying to explain what they saw. Look, everything's flying apart. In our inductive experience, when we see things flying apart like that, it's the aftermath of an explosion. Maybe that's what happened in this case. Even though nobody had ever seen a universe exploding into existence, nonetheless, this strong pattern of things rushing away from each other, you know, it was a natural conclusion. Hey, you know, looks like a big explosion. So I view intelligent design as doing something similar. You know, this might have philosophical, theological implications, but we're not trying to attack anything. We're not trying to, you know, do anything other than say, look at this stuff. Look at these machines. They're machines. Everybody calls them machines. They, you know, they're outboard motors. They're little trucks. They're highways. There are, you know, road signs and stuff in the cell. This is what we find in design systems. And so it may make people uncomfortable, some people. Other people might like it. Other people cheered the Big Bang. So it might be kind of divisive in that sense, but it's simply trying to explain the data. So it's not trying to attack anything, just trying to essentially explain what we see.
Okay, we'll go over the question here.
I'm an MD, PhD student here. And I did my PhD in microbiology.
So you didn't pass? You have to do another PhD?
I have to do the MD too, exactly. They won't let me go. But my research there is on plasmid conjugation. And for those of you in the audience who might not be familiar with plasmids, they're genetic elements, kind of like little chromosomes, if you will, that replicate autonomously in the cell. And can, in some cases, be transferred from bacteria to bacteria. And when you look at the sequence of the plasmids, you'll see a part of it that looks like one class of plasmid, and perhaps another part of it that looks like another class of plasmid, and so forth, as if these plasmids have recombined with one another and different modules being collected from one part and from another part and so forth. The specific plasmid we work on has a very complex genetic regulation of the expression of many of these genes, which, when you look at it from a design perspective, seems to be more complicated than is necessary. And some of us speculate that this system of controlling the expression of these conjugation genes may have been assembled from different parts that served other functions. I'm wondering whether the idea of different modules or parts of modules even recombining with one another allows for the possibility of random mutation events in all of these other systems. And then you get the right recombination, you get a whole new system, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Have you considered that? I should add, philosophically, I have no problem with the design hypothesis. I'm a devout Christian. But I think looking at it from the other point of view, we need to consider other alternative possibilities, and I wanted to get your sense on this.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Yeah, that's entirely possible. I mean, there are mechanisms operative.